Hello, my name's Craig Barton, and welcome to the Tips for Teachers podcast, the show that helps you supercharge your teaching one idea at a time. This episode, I have the absolute pleasure of speaking to geography teacher, author, and expert illustrator, David Goodwin. And this is an absolutely brilliant conversation. I love this one. One big piece of news before we crack on with the episode, and that is the Tips for Teachers book, when you're listening to this, is officially out now. I'm so excited about this. I've put everything I've got into this, and John Catt, the illustrator, the editor, have done an amazing job making all my geography ideas make sense and be brilliant. And I'm really excited to get it out there and see what people think. If you go to the Tips for Teachers website, there's a whole page about the book where you can see all the content, access all the resources, and even read the introduction, and there's links to buy it from Amazon, John Catt. You can get it anywhere. I thought what I'd do, I'd just give you, try and hook you in on the book, just tell you a little bit about it. So the tagline is over 400 ideas to improve your teaching. And what I've tried to do is make this one of the most practical books out there, so you can dip in at any stage and you'll come away with loads of ideas that you can try the very next time you step into a classroom. So if I look here, chapter 2 is all about habits and routines, and what we've got there are things like 8 ideas to help introduce a routine, 4 words to consider removing from your teaching vocabulary, means of participation. That's a massive chapter that I'm obsessed with, the means of participation. So you've got things like 10 ideas to improve cold call, 22 ideas to improve use of mini whiteboards, 15 ideas to improve discussions, and so on. You've got checking for understanding. There's a whole load of tips about wait times, but then you've got things like 10 ideas to improve exit tickets, 10 ideas to help create a culture of error, and so on. Responsive teaching, 7 ideas if a student says I don't know. Prior knowledge, you've got how to plan, prioritize, assess, and respond to prior knowledge. Massive chapter on explanations, where you've got things like 14 ideas to improve silent teacher, 5 ideas to show students why what we're learning today matters, and so on and so forth. I've tried to cover all the kind of big ideas in teaching, and the ideas come from 2 different sources, well, 3 different sources, really. They come from the wonderful guests that I've spoke to on the Tips for Teachers podcast. They come from my reading of various bits of research, blogs, and so on. But I guess the biggest source of inspiration is the classrooms that I'm lucky enough to visit every single week in schools all around the country and all around the world. And I'm just picking up nuggets of gold from the teachers and students that I'm working with. And I've tried to bang it all into the book. One extra thing to say about the book is that at the end of each tip, there's a QR code and a URL. And both of those take you to a resources page on the website where I put videos, blogs, research, downloadable resources, and so on if you want to dig deeper into the idea. Anyway, I'll shut up about that now, but that's Tips for Teachers book, out now in all good and evil bookstores. Anyway, back to the show. Let's get learning with today's guest, the wonderful David Goodwin. Spoiler alert, here are David's 5 tips. Tip number 1, provide opportunities for students to read in lessons. Tip 2, develop vocabulary. Tip 3, rebrand homework as practice. A really interesting one, that, you know. Tip 4, how to improve students' ability to write. And tip 5, how to make retrieval practice work. As ever, all the tips are timestamped, so you can jump straight to the one you want to listen to first. And videos of David's tips, like, and this is true for all guests, are available on the Tips for Teachers website if you want to share them with colleagues. Enjoy the show. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome David Goodwin to the Tips for Teachers podcast. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fab, Craig. Thank you for having me. It's a real
pleasure. No, it's my pleasure. For the benefit of listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, ideally in a sentence?
I am an assistant principal in charge of teaching and learning, and I do a bit of writing and illustrating of education ideas. My subject is geography, and I'm a secondary practitioner.
Fantastic. I think this is the first geography teacher we've had on here, so you're a world first this for the podcast. I'm very excited about this. Right, David, let's dive straight in. What's tip number 1 you've got for us today?
Tip number 1, and it might be sort of 3 tips in one, is to do with reading and providing opportunities for students to read in lessons. So something I'm very, very passionate about, and something I try to do frequently in my lessons is have students read. And it stems really from my own sort of personal experiences when I was at school and I wasn't the most I wasn't the best reader, and it's sort of that's why I'm really, really passionate about it. So what I'll go through is sort of like how I go about selecting the text that I have my students read, why we do it and how we do it, and some things that I've found that have worked, and ideas that I've sort of pinched from other people, because I'm a bit of a magpie when it comes to ideas. So the first thing I'd say is this: reading outside of the 6,000 most common used words in the English language, outside those first 6,000, you're more likely to encounter the less frequent words through text. So by the end of secondary school, students should know somewhere in the region of 15,000 to 20,000 words. So if we're not providing opportunities for them to reading our lessons, if we're not providing those opportunities, how are they going to develop them? So the first thing that I would sort of suggest is engaging with your sort of subject communities and finding texts and materials that are really that have been found to be useful for whatever it is you're teaching. I don't think you need to reinvent the wheel. There's no reason why you can't use credible resources such as a textbook, for example, or a book that might be relevant to whatever it is you're teaching. So the first part is about selecting the text. And I really like this idea that Mary Might says about selecting a piece of text that is above the student's pay grade, that's more ambitious than perhaps that they should be able to read at their age. So something that's a year above what they would be expected to read at that point. So once I've selected a piece of text, the first thing that I'm sort of thinking about is I'm going to go through that passage of text that I want students to read, either as a whole class or something that I'm going to read to them. And I'll start by highlighting all of the sort of tier two vocabulary, the sort of words that not specific to my subject, but are more sophisticated than the tier one everyday vocabulary that we use. So we're going to highlight them, and I'm going to either do one of two things. I'm going to pre-teach those words, or I'm going to think about how I can teach as I'm reading through that piece of text. Or I might, if I think the students have encountered them previously, I might look at some activities around how I can check that they've got that prerequisite understanding before we begin reading the text. Because if they haven't got that understanding, everything that comes afterwards, you're just setting the students up to fail. So the first thing is about trying to find out, you know, do they understand it? If not, addressing that, and then we can start to get into the reading. So how I go about making it work is, there are a variety of things that I do. First is to make the reading accountable. Like, we want to set up activities, and we want to set up things that are going to require the students to engage in the reading. One of my favourite sort of things to do is to have students read to the rest of the class. But I'm aware that for some students, when they first encounter this, it's quite daunting. It can be quite tricky, especially if the text is like littered with words that are either difficult to pronunciate or just things that are really unfamiliar to them. So I go about setting students up with the confidence to do so. So for example, what we will do as a class is we'll engage in things like choral chants. So for a difficult word like cumulonimbus cloud, for example, I'll have the whole class say that three or four times. So as a class, I'll go, right class, this is how we pronounce it, cumulonimbus, and I'll display it up on the whiteboard in its sort of phonetic spelling, and I'll go 3, 2, 1, cumulonimbus, and I'll have the whole class chant cumulonimbus, and we'll do that three or four times, then we'll select one row, and that one row will say that, and I'll go to another row, and I'll begin to narrow it down, so I'll get like sort of one or two students to get them to say that, so that when that one student that encounters that word in that reading, when they have to say that, they don't feel as awkward, as silly. They haven't been set up to fail. So I like to use choral chants as a way of sort of building that confidence. And for students that are really reluctant when they first start doing this, you know, maybe I'll start off as small as just having them read one sentence, one paragraph, you know, just really sort of just building them up in terms of their level of confidence to read in front of others. The other thing that I've stumbled across more recently, which I wasn't really aware of until I read about it, was Alex Quigley's echo reading, where the teacher reads the body of text first, reads a passage of text, and then the students in pairs will read that back to one another. And the idea being that the teacher's modelled the reading, modelled how to pronunciate the words and sort of the pace and all of that sort of stuff. And then the students can read to one another, and again, increasing their ability to engage in the text. And then also as the teacher, as they're sort of engaging with that echo reading, it's that chance for you to check for understanding and to listen to what is going on around the classroom. So that's another thing that I do. One of my sort of top tips, if you're going to engage in sort of whole class reading, is, and it's super simple, is to number the, if you've got the text that is, so if the text is electronic and you've been able to copy it into Microsoft Word, is to insert line numbers. So you insert line numbers, it's such a time saver. So you say, right, Bobby, I want you to read lines 1 to 6, or I want you to start from line 6, and you're going to keep reading, and I'm going to say, right, stop. And then when it comes to the sort of students having to do something with that information, whether it be some sort of question, some sort of activity that you want them to do around it, and they'll, you know, say, I'm struggling with, you know, this question, I'm struggling with this problem. All right, well, have you thought about reading back through lines 10 through to 18, for example? So you just read that, you know, really directs the focus. And that was something that I first see Ben Ranson, geography teacher. I don't know if you follow him, Craig, on Twitter, he's superb. But it's just such a simple idea. So to summarise so far, my sort of top tips, because I do this quite a bit. I get lost in my and sort of when we're top tips. Pre-teach the tier two vocabulary. Pre-teach the tier two vocabulary. Find ways to make the reading accountable. So designing activities around forcing the students to engage in it. If you're going to engage in whole class reading, make sure that any difficult to pronounce words, you pre-teach that and you engage all students in sort of those choral chants. The kids love it as well as them not feeling as reluctant to read those words. And the echo reading. So teacher reads, teacher models it, and the students read back. So there's
I love this.
Yeah. There's just something so enjoyable to hear students read. It just, as I said, I don't know what it is, but it's just, there's something really, really enjoyable about it. And when they can begin to make meaning from the text that you're engaging with, it's a joy to see and hear.
Right, this is lovely, this, David. Right, I need to dig into this, because one of the main reasons I started this Tips for Teachers podcast is, with my Mr. Bart Maths podcast, I was getting too bogged down in the maths and I wanted to spread it out a bit. And since I've started it, Christopher Such has been on and he's taught me all about this, about reading from a young age, and it's blown my mind. So I'm a bit obsessed with this now. So a couple of reflections and then I've got a big question for you. So the first is, one thing we often discuss on this podcast is means of participation. And whenever I think of reading out loud, I always think of the kind of one-to-one. So you say to one child, you read this back to me.
Yeah.
But what I love about what you're saying here is a couple of variations to that. I love this chant, this call and response. I'm a bit obsessed with this just generally as a way of checking for understanding. But I really like that to deal with those tricky words. And the paired reading sounds fascinating as well, whether it's combined with the echo thing, which sounds a fantastic idea. But just, I really like paired work as a means of kind of rehearsing in front of a pair of friendly ears versus having to read out loud in front of 30 kids. So I love that. And again, as you've said, it gives you an opportunity to wander around the class, get a sense of what's going on and stuff. So that feels really, really powerful. I guess my big question is, obviously you're a geography teacher, but you've got kind of whole school responsibilities and you'll have a good sense of what's going on in other subjects. Is this doable, or do you find maths departments, science departments and so on doing this? And what advice would you have for teachers of those subjects?
So it's a great question, because I have had conversations with people, maths teachers in particular, about I wouldn't want to impose or direct you to do something that doesn't serve the purpose. So for example, there's not always, I'm not going to have students read around everything I teach with my subject. So for example, when first encountering how a waterfall forms, it might not be the best way to encounter that new knowledge through reading about it. It might require me with my visualizer and actually a really carefully thought out, well scripted explanation. So I wouldn't try to artificially, you know, force the issue if there's not a genuine purpose behind it. But I can't foresee why there isn't an opportunity in all curriculum areas where reading can't take place. I'm sure in all subjects, and you know, I wouldn't want to speak on behalf of the science community or the maths community. I'm sure there is an opportunity in all subjects if we really carefully think about where we could encounter new information via reading. And what I find quite interesting, and when we if you study etymology and the origins of words, and how most of the sort of, or a lot of scientific, mathematical and geographical language derives from ancient Greece. So when we start to unpick the etymology of words and the prefixes, and students can begin to identify those patterns cross-curricular. So those sort of opportunities across curriculum areas, I think are fascinating and can be very, very rewarding.
Yeah, I agree. You often see etymology is one of the big areas that literacy, I guess, does find its way into the maths classroom. And as you say, the common prefixes and suffixes. But the irony of all of this, David, is that like the questions, I always have my maths hat on. Whoever I'm talking to, I always find a way to wheel it back to maths somehow. So apologies for this. But the irony of all of this is, if you look at exam papers in maths, the questions that kids do the worst on invariably are the ones that have got a bit of a story attached to them, two or three sentences. So there's definitely a need for this. It's just, I think, from my perspective, it's trying to find what are those kind of texts that we can use that enhance students' understanding. Because what you don't really want to be doing is that reading in maths is just reading these worded problems about, you know, Tom and Jane are sharing sweets in a ratio 3-2. I mean, that's not quite the inspiring literacy, you know, literature I had in mind. It just feels difficult, but I want to do this because I hear from people like you, I hear from people like Chris Such and Claire Seeley that this feels an important thing. It's just, for those trickier subjects, you want a way to get it in there that doesn't feel shoehorned, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, tricky one. Anything more to say on this tip, David, before I cut you off and move on to tip two?
Yeah, so I mean, tip two sort of builds on my first sort of tip in terms of reading, which is to develop vocab. So through sort of thinking about how we can make meaning from reading, how we get the most out of it, how we go about developing students' vocabulary, and I cannot for the life of me remember who first said this. I want to say it was Tom Sherrington, about how many words do we have students that we need students to use, but we don't actually provide opportunities for them to speak the words and say the words. And it really just struck me. I was like, what have I been doing for so long? Like, I've got my fabulous keyword display up at the back of my classroom that no one ever looked at. So what have I been doing that, like, my students aren't saying these words? So providing opportunities for students to say the words and to develop the vocabulary is, again, really, really important and really powerful. So here's some of my sort of tips. We developed this thing called kernel sentences. So this is sort of an original idea, so to speak. It was through working with Oliver Cavaglioli on our Organised Ideas book. So the idea is, with a kernel sentence, is you introduce the meaning of a word in as few words as possible. So it's really, really pithy, and you replace all of the sort of more sophisticated language in your sentence with everyday, more memorable words. Because the idea here is, what you want to do is just get students saying the word and being able to remember it. So for example, you might say, erosion is the breakup and removal of rocks. That's the sentence. And so I'll say to my class, I'll say, right class, erosion, so, you know, it's a new term we're going to be using. It's the breakup and removal of rocks. So when rocks are broken up and removed, we call it erosion. So I'll go through that 3 or 4 times. And then again, we go through a choral chant. So I'll say to my class, right class, erosion is, and they choral chant back to me, the breakup and removal of rocks. And again, we'll do it 3 or 4 times, and I'll go row by row, and I'll pick on 1 or 2 students. And I usually pick on the students who either I'm concerned might not be engaging in it, or might be more reluctant to, or other ones that might need the sort of nudging the most help. And the idea being that if they can do it, I can safely assume and be assured that the rest of the class can. And the idea here really is simple. It's just about building students' fluency and ability to be able to use that word. Now, if students can recall that erosion is the breakup and removal of rocks, that doesn't mean they've fully understood what erosion is. But what I would say is, it does mean that they've got a hook. They've got something that they can build on top of. So lessons down the line when we begin to introduce different types of erosion and the factors that determine rates of erosion, I'm not having to reteach the basics of what erosion is. So that's one way in which I do it. Call chants, again, makes it super memorable. And when you have students then put that into practice in their own writing and they begin to generate their own ideas around it, it makes it far more likely that they're going to be able to recall it. So kernel sentences, really, really pithy, really sharp. And the idea is about being able to remember, word for word what we've sort of rehearsed. And again, you can do this in those sort of that peer dynamic, and I really like what you said there, Craig, about students rehearsing sort of peer share before doing it in front of the rest of the class, so they've got again that confidence to share their thinking with the rest of the class. Other ways in which I sort of go around vocab development is peer quizzing, so things like using a knowledge organizer, setting them up in a dynamic where they're going to quiz one another before I open up to a sort of cold call and a more sort of more formal forum, so to speak, and then building on top of that, having them sort of really train students to really delve deeper into their students' understanding. So start to interrogate them and ask more elaborate questions like, you know, what does that word mean? You know, could you use that word in a sentence? Where else might you encounter this word? Can you think of any other words that are different but might have a similar or the same meaning?
Wow, love this. Now, this is, again, something that feels definitely relevant to teachers of all subjects, because every subject has, obviously, its fair share of technical vocabulary. Mm. So two reflections and then one question for you, David. I'm a big fan as well of, I think it was Tom Sherrington who makes this point, that the words we expect our students to write are very different from the normal natural dialogue that may appear in the classroom without, and he suggests these kind of almost stem sentences or verbal prompts to try and get students to talk in the way they're right. I think it's a really, really powerful idea, that. And again, just to reiterate what I said before, the choral chant, if you'd have asked me a year ago, would my kids ever do any chanting, I'd be like, you've lost your mind, no chance. But every time I see this in a school, like the way it just brings like class cohesion, and the kids absolutely love it, don't they? And it's brilliant. Like you said, it's a really good tool of mass participation. It's quick, it's snappy, it's engaging. I'm a big, big fan of that. So I'm definitely going to start building that into the vocab. I like that. And as you say, it only works if you have these really tight sentences. Yeah. Otherwise, it's not going to work if the kids are chanting 30 or 40 word, babble definition. So I love that. My question for you is this. I'll tell you where I've gone wrong with this. Is I go to town on the vocab in the lesson or the sequence of lessons that we're doing it. So let's say, for example, we're doing something on shapes. I'm going to town on the etymology of polygons, hexagons, and all that kind of thing. But then I don't revisit it enough. So like the kids seem to get it in the moment, but then, you know, like anything, a month later, you know, the classic forgetting curve, it's gone. So do you kind of factor in retrieval opportunities for this kind of vocab so that your kids don't fall into the traps that my kids have and end up forgetting it and all the hard work goes to waste, if that makes sense?
Yeah, yes, and not necessarily in a sort of choral chant manner. I don't intentionally do that, but if I start to unpick, if I start to unearth, like sort of as I'm sampling books or as we're sort of looking for feedback opportunities, if I begin to see that sort of degrading, you know, and beginning to forget those terms, then yes, I'll revisit it through that. I suppose what starts to happen is they begin to use the words more frequently in their written pieces, and I'm sort of really intentional about. I'm just thinking year 10 example not long ago where we were looking at coastal landscapes and how rigorous I went about teaching coastal processes before we introduced the landforms. The teaching of the landforms was so much easier for them to grasp and for them to really to be able to stretch and challenge, because they already had really, really secure foundational knowledge of all of those different coastal processes. So I think you have to be really, I suppose, intentionally in terms of curriculum planning, like what opportunities are there for it. And then geography, I hate speaking on behalf of other subjects, but geography just seems to be so rich in connections and linked concepts across subjects. So I'm always thinking about, you know, what we're teaching today, what does that what has come before it that looks like it should, that is going to help them there. So I'm thinking about, for example, differential heating and why the equator is the warmest place on Earth and the formation of ecosystems. There's always those opportunities there, but I suppose, to answer your question, I'm not intentional about necessarily coral chanting it again in the future, but there, yeah, plenty of opportunities for them to revisit and use those words in some form.
Got it. Fantastic. Right, David, what is tip number three for us, please?
So, tip number three, to do with homework. So, we, as a school, we are moving away from, we're not calling it homework anymore, we're calling it practice. And I think the biggest problem with homework is when you're expecting students to engage in something that is unfamiliar to them, or, and this is why I'm not the biggest fan of sort of flipped learning, where they have to, where students have to encounter something that maybe they're going to learn in the future, because what you're sort of setting students up to do is, or in my opinion, what I think you're sort of setting students up to do is for them to go home and encounter something on their own, or possibly with the help of a parent that isn't an expert in the subject and the content that you want them to engage in. And the chances are, if they can't, they're going to give up very, very quickly. So in terms of homework, my sort of, so it's not confusing, so it can't, so there's no excuse that that students can't engage in the content that you want them to, make sure that it just builds upon what they're doing in the lessons, and provide plenty of opportunities for students to practice. So essentially our homework policy, or our, the way in which we're doing homework now, is we've created what we're calling practice booklets. So it's essentially 2 pages of knowledge and then so many weeks worth of practice activities. And then it's, so it's in broken up with knowledge, practice, knowledge, practice, knowledge, practice. And it just builds upon what is being learnt in terms of the curriculum, what's being learnt in the classroom. Simply because, as I've said, if we encounter information that's unfamiliar to us without the expert being the teacher there, we're far likely to develop misconceptions, we're far likely to disengage with it if it becomes too tricky, too difficult. And we also have to factor in that for some children, unfortunately, they might not have the means to participate in the manner that you wish for them to do so. So there's lots of fantastic platforms, you know, Seneca, Carousel, all fantastic, superb packages that students can access. But if they haven't got the means by which to participate, i.e. they've only got one computer and a household of three siblings, it becomes really difficult. So what I would say is consider how you want your students to participate in their homework. Make it something that is going to be simple to understand in terms of how to engage with the activity, and use it as an opportunity to actually build their memory, build their knowledge, and develop everything in terms of their long-term memory.
This is good. This it's a biggie, homework. I'm really pleased you've brought this up. And again, it's always interesting to hear this from a different subject perspective. So just a couple of reflections and a few questions for you here, David. The thing about homework that I like in principle is it's the ideal retrieval opportunity, because the kids can spend a lot longer on it or focus on the areas they need. Whereas in class, there's often this requirement to kind of move at a certain pace. And if you need a bit longer on something, but the class is ready to move on, yeah, you don't get it. So in theory, homework's great. But as you say, there are a number of issues with homework. And we've certainly had in our school a whole cohort of students who just don't engage in homework for whatever reason. One thing that, where maths has a big advantage, I think, over lots of subjects, is we can go to town on kind of automated marking. So, you know, you can set kids online homework on pretty much all of maths, and it'll mark it for them. And I know that obviously with things like Carousel and Seneca, you can do that to a certain extent with other subjects. But how important is it for you that the kids know what to do when stuck on homework, if that makes sense? If you set a homework to a child, and if they come back to you the next lesson and say, look, sir, I couldn't do it because I was stuck, I didn't know what to do, is that like a valid excuse? Or do you have kind of protocols in there where essentially if kids are stuck, there's a definite kind of process they have to go through, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so what I've sort of outlined in terms of the practice booklets that we are moving to them, we haven't moved to them yet, but in terms of what they will do in them, it will be very similar in terms of what they're doing in the classroom. So it will be a lot of knowledge-based questions that require them to engage in the sort of pages of knowledge that are within the booklet. So it should, in theory, it should be relatively straightforward and self-explanatory in terms of what they need to do. But I do think it's important, and we're going to have this period of time, this transition, where we are going to need to train the students in terms of the expectations of how to go around engaging in it, what to do if you are stuck, what to do if you want to get further ahead, like you've shown mastery in this element, is there opportunity for you to go on and develop in further areas? So yeah, absolutely. I think you've got to outline your expectations, and you've got to follow them through, just like in anything that you do in school. But I do think it is really important that they have that opportunity to practice and to be trained on it, and not just the students as well, but I think the parents as well. They've got an opportunity. So at the front of the booklet, there's sort of like a little blurb to the parents that explains the forgetting curve and the importance of practice and the simple memory model. There's going to be a video on the school website about how to go about completing the practice tasks and then this sort of thing, where if your child is stuck, or if they do encounter anything that they can't do, what do you do in that situation? So a sort of bit of a FAQ, a bit of a troubleshooting, so to speak.
Yeah, it's good that. I love that. Just the whole purpose of homework, I think, is a really interesting one. I think I've made that mistake in the past, where obviously I know why I'm setting homework to the kids, but do the kids know?
No.
I think that the idea of having the forgetting curve on that, I think, is really smart. Just last question on this, David. When Adam Boxer was on the show, he made the point that the biggest thing he's done in terms of homework is to make sure it feeds into lessons. And I think that's a mistake I've made for many years. Homework's almost like this separate thing. You know, you set it, and then, okay, maybe at the start of the next lesson, I'll have a word with a couple of the kids who haven't done the homework or whatever. But then it's like, great, and we move on. Now it's back to classwork. The more I think about it, the more I'm on board with this, that homework really needs to play a pivotal role in lessons. I wonder if you agree, and I wonder what role homework plays in your lessons, David.
I do agree. And one of the sort of pieces of work for planning for these practice booklets was, I was listening to what Adam had said on your show, and he'd written a blog, I think, through Carousel about the idea of practice and the benefits of it. And I think everything I've sort of said so far probably just builds on what Adam said. I think it's important it builds on what's going on in the lesson for two main reasons. Number one, it takes the guesswork out of how to engage in the activity that the students need to do. So there's that, it's less likely that the students are going to get stuck, so I can't do my homework. And then number two, you're building that strong foundational knowledge that means students are going to progress, students are going to learn. And absolutely. I can't think of, when I reflect on how I've done things in the past, I can't think of why I ever did it like that. There's got to be opportunities from time to time where you go off piece, especially in a subject like geography, where maybe you go off piece and, you know, something's come up in the news, and it's going to enrich whatever it is that you're doing in your curriculum at that moment in time. But what I would say is, thinking about Tom Sherrington's mode A, mode B, 80, that sort of 80-20 model, 80% of the time, 80%+ of the time, students should be practicing and developing their knowledge around what is going on in the lessons in your curriculum.
Brilliant, that. Fantastic. Okay, David, what's tip four, please?
Tip four. I'm going to writing, like planning for writing and how to develop students' ability to write, because I think we greatly, this is just my sort of crude opinion, we sort of valorize the unaided mind, like we want students to be able to independently work and work independently and absolutely we want that, but we need to do that at the right time, so when students have got a sufficient amount of knowledge. So in terms of sort of how I develop my students' writing, it's about them having enough knowledge before I want them to engage in sort of an extended piece of writing. So I'm not just going to say, okay, class, we've had a lesson on hard and soft engineering of rivers, and now we're going to evaluate how successful strategies have been. We won't do that. So we need to make sure that students have got a sufficient amount of knowledge before they're ready to engage in that. So that comes through things like retrieval practice, lots of checking for understanding, so our cold call or pair share, lots of practice activities, and then we can go about how we're going to sort of get them to the point where they're going to produce a really nice piece of structured writing. And this is all about scaffolding, and obviously eventually we're going to pull that scaffolding away. So the first part of this is students have to retrieve some knowledge, retrieve some information. So we've collected all of their ideas, and then through sort of like pair share and cold call, we call any ideas that don't sort of stand up to the piece of work that we're doing, don't stand up to the question or the purpose of the writing activity. From there, we need to think about how we can organise our ideas. So this is thinking about my work with Oliver in terms of our book Organised Ideas. How can we organise our ideas so that when it comes to the writing aspect of the activity, the mind is free to engage in the act of writing as opposed to thinking about what it is that I should be writing about. So here we're thinking about the structure. And if I think about certain things that I've done with students that have worked really, really well, if once we've gone through collecting the ideas, we represent our ideas through some sort of graphical mean, like a graphic organizer, like a mind map, for example. Once I've got students to the stage where they're really, really fluent at doing that and are skilled at doing that, I can show them how each element of their diagram could be transformed and translated into a distinct paragraph within their piece of text. So we go about the collection of ideas for the retrieval practice, we organise our ideas, and now we're free to begin writing. And this always, it blows my mind, and I think for some students, I had a Year 7 student last year said to me, "Sir, why can't all subjects teach me to write like this?" He just flew away with it, and it was so fantastic to see, because I failed to see how any other sort of way, any other technique, and I'm sure I'm wrong, I'm sure there's lots of other great ideas out there, but for that student at that time, I failed to see any other way that he would have got to that point without that sort of sequence. So it's really, really carefully thought out about what are the main ideas I want students to be able to express and show their understanding, how are they going to organise it, and again, lots of modelling, lots of use of the visualiser, and then how they're going to transform and translate that into their own understanding, and how they're going to write about that. So that final act of the writing, the first part is always me modelling and demonstrating, students having a go at the next paragraph on their own, and me walking around, lots of reading, maybe getting some students' work underneath the visualizer until I feel confident. I say, off you go. You're free to run away with it, and it's not something, because of the investment in time, it is an investment in time, it's not something I use frequently, but I do look at 1 to 2 opportunities per half term with a class where we're going to produce an extended piece of writing that we're going to place emphasis on. It we're going to provide opportunities afterwards for us to go back and refine it and improve it and redraft that piece of work. So it's something that's at the end of it, they can be particularly proud of, but also something that we can really, really push and stretch the students.
This is good, this, David. This is really good. So this is another area where I'm completely out of my depth on here, because again, all I can relate to here is those kind of multi-step problems in maths where kids have to be quite structured and write a few sentences and a bit of work in. And again, my kids are often terrible at them, so I need to get better. So I'll tell you where I'm at here, and I've got a couple of questions for you. So one mistake I've made in the past is just assuming kids can write in a coherent, organized, fluent way. And that is a faulty assumption, to say the least. One thing I've found helps, but I think I'm still missing a key piece here, is doing what we talked about earlier, where you get kids to kind of almost talk in sentences as a bridge to then writing in sentences. So using those verbal stems and prompts and simple things in maths, like the answer is this because, just to make sure kids get into that habit of not just saying it's 27 and so on and so forth. But what I'm really intrigued by here is this almost middle step that you've got in, because you've talked about kind of speaking to collect the ideas, but then you've got this organizational part of it. And that feels like the absolute key part of this process. Now, of course, you've got a whole book on this, David, but I wonder if you can just give us a few little kind of key takeaways. What does this look like, this organising? Are we talking kind of mind maps, diagrams? What's an effective way for kids to do this?
So there are, we arrived at four different types of organiser, and these four categories are sort of ubiquitous throughout conversations around knowledge, but they might crop up as different through using different terms. So, for example, one group of the organisers would be chunk, where you're defining and you're categorising things. So if, for example, I'm looking at the characteristics of hard and soft engineering strategies of river management, I'm defining, I'm chunking, I'm categorising, I'm organising so that I can define something. You could then look at how you can compare and contrast ideas or compare and contrast concepts. So again, that's a distinct category. So we've got chunk, we've got compare, and then we've got sequence. So certain things that we want students to write about are going to be in some sort of sequence. If I want students to write about the formation of sand dunes, there's a clear sequence of events that results in the formation of a sand dune. And then finally, if there is I want students to engage in cause and effect, there's a group of organisers that best represent knowledge and information for cause and effect. So when it comes to organising, we select one of the organisers that best represents the information that we want students to then go on to write about. And when they're organising their ideas, to save time, there's a variety of little tricks. So we can create templates. We, you know, I will model how to go about constructing them in the first instance. And again, it's really worth pointing out here that it is an investment in time, and it's not something that I would always do. But if I think it's going to serve a purpose, which when it comes to sort of extended pieces of writing, it does, that, you know, that's why I'm going to do it. So when they go, once they've constructed their organizer, there's again a variety of different things we can do in terms of check for understanding. So we can have peer-to-peer explanations. So we can have students actually engaging in that. One of the things I've done more recently, which absolutely was just worked so well, was rather than building, creating an organizer and a lesson, do it incrementally, spread the load. So for example, at the sort of every 2 to 3 lessons, at the end of the lesson, I'd say, right, class, you're now going to create a new branch of your mind map. So on that branch of the mind map, you're going to summarize everything that you've learned in the last 2 to 3 lessons. And then the next lesson they came in, and before they did any sort of retrieval practice, the first thing they do is they get the mind map out and they explain each of the branches to their peer, put your mind map away, now we're going to engage in some retrieval practice. And the reason I sort of did that was there's a piece of, there's been two pieces of research just recently about how having some sort of practice or rehearsal before retrieval practice, and I don't know the specific neuroscience ideas behind it, but it triggers something in terms of memory traces that enhances the retrieval practice effect. So we had them doing that. A few lessons down the line, because they've spread the load in terms of the times of constructing the organizer, we haven't invested so much time in one book or lesson. Now we're free to use this as some sort of tool to help us learn. And that's the important thing. Like, we're not creating a mind map for the sake of creating a mind map. We're creating it so that it's a tool that serves a purpose. It helps augment our thinking, helps organise our ideas so that when it comes to writing, our mind's a little bit more free. Our working memory's not constrained. We're trying to juggle the act of writing, the complexities of syntax, and all of the ideas and concepts we want our students to write about. It's not overburdened, so to speak.
I love this. Just one final question on this one. Now, pretty much every episode on Tips for Teachers podcast, we mention mini whiteboards, right? And it always kicks off. So I don't want to break a habit here. So I'm a big fan of mini whiteboards. And in the past, I've used them just for, you know, checking for understanding of single responses. So what's 5 times 6, put them on your whiteboard and so on. But the more I've messed around over the last few months, the more I see the potential, certainly in maths, for them to be used for more kind of complex answers. So maybe the kids actually, you know, write 5 or 6 lines on these mini whiteboards, and they do them as, instead of writing in their text in their exercise book, because they can then swap them more easily with the person next to them. As you mentioned before, the teacher can grab them and stick them under the visualizer more, or hold them up. Do, in terms of getting the kids better at writing, do mini whiteboards play any role at all for you, David, in this particular aim?
Yes. Do you know what? There's a few things that that I like about them. Number one is you always have the really, really conscientious student that doesn't want to commit to paper in the because they're frightened they're going to get it wrong.
Yes.
I don't want to, because if I've got to cross it out, my book's going to look messy. So I think for that straight away, giving them sort of like, this is a rough draft, here's your opportunity to rehearse it, that's really useful. I also like to use them as well as, I've modelled something to the class, and I like to model similar problems or similar scenarios, but not the, you know, not the one that I want them to have a go at themselves. Now you have a go at writing your first 2 to 3 sentences on those mini whiteboards. Right, now turn to your partner and read it to them and give one another feedback. Like, how well does that stand up to the model, you know, the model example that Mr. Goodwin just shared with us? Give each other feedback, rework it, redraft it, and then when they feel confident, you know, and as the teacher, when you feel confident that you're going to get those high levels of success, now commit to paper. So yeah, absolutely. I think I sort of walk around now with one in my hand as I'm working with students, like when they're working independently, and I'm scanning and reading, right, you know, giving them some pointers, leave the mini whiteboard there, come back, collect it, rub it out and give it to someone else. So yeah, as a sort of tool to help students rehearse and practice and ready for committing to paper. Yeah, they're super powerful. I did love your session with Adam on mini whiteboards. I think it was great.
He's good, isn't he? He never shuts up, but he talks a lot of sense. He's good. All right, David, what's tip number five, please?
So tip number five, just retrieval. Like, retrieval practice, how to make it work, how to get the most out of it so it doesn't just become sort of pub quizzy. And I think we've probably as a community spoken about retrieval practice a lot, and it's arguably the closest thing we're going to get to a silver bullet, but how do we sort of get the most out of it so that, as I said, it doesn't sort of become pub quizzy and simple acts of just retrieving. So I think I've touched upon a few things already, the idea of providing opportunities to practice, but also just making sure that whatever you want, if you're about to introduce something new and it's the first time that, or you might think that students have been taught it before, but you don't want to assume, how can you use your retrieval practice as a means by which to check that the prerequisite knowledge is there, that there's a safe level of understanding there so that you are ready to begin introducing the new content. So example that springs to mind immediately, if I want to teach my students about the distribution of the tropical rainforest, it would be really, really useful if they can recall why the equator is the warmest place on Earth. Like, that would be really, really useful information. It would be even more useful if they understood atmospheric circulation and why the equator happens to be the wettest place on Earth, because it's sort of immediately we can get away from this misconception that deserts are found along the equator because it's really hot, which isn't the case. Deserts aren't found along the equator. Along the equator, it's really hot and really wet. So I can check they've got that prerequisite knowledge about why the equator is the warmest place on the Earth, as well as think about how I might be able to unearth any sort of misconceptions through carefully planning out my retrieval practice. So I think it's really important that I'm sort of going through a transition at a whole school level where retrieval practice for a lot of the teachers in my school is going to be something that is relatively new to them. So I'm trying to think about systematically how I'm introducing that to my colleagues. So at the moment, we just have what we call sort of like a high five recall, and the idea is that it's 5 simple recall questions. But what we're sort of doing here is we're training the teachers and the students to get familiar with the routines around how that's going to work. And sort of the next step is thinking about how we can be better at engineering our questions so that they do build into what is being, and so we're activating those, you know, those concepts that are within our schema to prepare for the new content that's being introduced. So I think it's really important that, you know, if retrieval practice isn't something that's taken place in your school or it's something that's new to you, establishing the routines that, you know, as you said earlier, create the means of participation into how we're going to go about doing retrieval practice is really important, and not to sort of try and sprint before you can walk, really sort of progressively build it up so that it becomes more sophisticated and it becomes, you know, progressively more challenging as well. And it's sort of a little bit of a journey. I think if I think back to 3 or 4 years ago of my own practice, I was pretty much quiz, retrieval, but not really carefully thinking about how it could be done in a really thoughtful and meaningful way so that it does activate prior knowledge and does help build on what has come before it.
I love this. Any opportunity to talk about retrieval, I'm always more than happy, so I'm really pleased you brought this up. So I have two big questions for you here, David, and again, I don't think there's easy answers to these because I'm always wrestling with these, but I'm always interested in getting other people's take. So the first one is, a mistake I've made, and you've alluded to this, is my retrieval practice has always been these kind of shallow knowledge, kind of quiz style questions. And my concern there is that, let's say on a scheme of work, and I'm intrigued whether this holds true in geography as well. Let's say you've got 2 weeks to teach a topic, whatever it is, percentages. By the end of those 2 weeks, the kids are probably doing some quite sophisticated things with percentages, some quite nice problem solving and so on and so forth. But then flash forward to 4 weeks later and all of a sudden a percentage question appears in your do now or your start or your homework. Invariably, it's going to be back to almost kind of surface level knowledge. Very rarely do retrieval opportunities provide the depth of thinking that kids have been exposed to when they've been learning the topic and which they need to be exposed to understand something. So is that something that you can relate to, David, perhaps either in your subject, in your prior teaching or in your school, that often the retrieval doesn't go as deep as perhaps it needs to?
Yeah, there's a time consideration as well, isn't there? So you've got to weigh up how much time can you invest in the retrieval as well as introducing new content. But I think it's a bit foolish to sort of move on if what they need to know that's come before it isn't really secure. But then equally, you've got to think about time. So I look at, again, a few sort of big opportunities within the curriculum where the retrieval that you can do is going to be really meaningful and really challenging. And again, you can't do this all of the time, but think back to something I did with a year 11s a couple of years ago, where we were introducing, it was about 3 or 4 lessons into a new topic, and what I wanted to do was show students how what they'd learnt previously linked to what they were learning. So the first part was we did some quite simple retrieval, some, you know, basic recall questions. Okay, so right, this first column, this is where your all of your answers are going to go in this first, just set up a simple table, all your answers are going to go in this first column. Now what I want you to think about, class, is here's some questions from some knowledge that we learned further back in time, and then some questions from even further. So we've got 3 columns of knowledge that had been learned previously. Now we're going to do some retrieval about what we're currently learning, these last 3 lessons, and then we're going to explore, between all of these concepts and ideas, how these different things link. So now what we've got here is we're not just superficially, you know, answering loads of questions. We're actually thinking about really where are the links between them. And I've thought about it really, really carefully in terms of what knowledge did I want students to encounter, but then equally what surprises might come along. So once we've done this sort of retrieval of these 3 topics and the current topic we're learning, we created a concept map that showed all of the links between all of these big ideas. But what I found through doing it was some students genuinely identified some genuine links that I hadn't thought about myself. And then from there, we went about actually producing a quite an extended piece of writing that demonstrated what they'd understood from the whole process. It probably took about one and a half to 2 lessons worth of sort of work to get to that point. But again, the depth and the breadth of knowledge that they covered, I cannot see any sort of other way that I could have covered that quantity and to that extent. And again, it's not something you can do all of the time, but it was a worthy investment because there was some really, really sort of big, meaty concepts that students hadn't considered in that sort of context before, and how everything sort of linked together.
That's really interesting. My second one is, And this happens in maths, and again, I'm intrigued on your take on this. There are certain things that tend to get left out of retrieval opportunities, and there are kind of two categories for these. So the first is, there's a load of topics in math that are just a bit of a pain to quiz kids on, because either they require specialist equipment, you know, like measuring angles, you've got to get out the protractors, or constructing perpendicular bisectors, outcome the compasses, and teachers are like, oh, for God's sake, you know, if I start my lesson with that, and the kids haven't, what I mean? So they tend to get kind of left out a little bit. And that's obviously a problem, because if we don't provide these retrieval opportunities, kids forget them. So that's one area that happens in maths. The other thing that I think is quite interesting as well is, there are quite a few topics in maths, and math teachers may shoot me down for this, but aren't actually prerequisite for that many other topics. So a good example here is rotation. So once the kids know how to rotate an object, that's kind of the end of the story there. It's not like that skill is going to be prerequisite for something that they then learn in year 10 or year 11. So if teachers are just relying on retrieval being prior knowledge, there's a danger that some topics may not bubble up as much as other topics. So I just wonder, do you encounter either of those two things, either the painful to quiz things that tend to get left out, or things that actually, it's not fair to say they're kind of one-offs, but almost they're not as much prior, they're not prerequisite as much as other things would be, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely the first one. Yeah, thinking grid references, using math, just anything where it's not, as a teacher, as well as thinking about everything else that we have, just managing time. So like, if we want to, you know, manage our workload, creating a whole host of practice tasks around, creating a whole load of practice tasks around four-figure, six-figure grid references, latitude and longitude, it's not the easiest thing. The second one, it's not something I can say for sure just off my head, but I'm sure there will be some concepts, some ideas that are less purposeful than others in terms of their links to, you know, new content and pre, you know, the idea of them being prerequisite knowledge. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just really about being really, really meticulous in terms of the curriculum planning and how, you know, the knowledge begets knowledge and how it builds on each other. And, you know, it's the idea that curriculum work's never done, isn't it? Like, it's, you can think that you've sort of got retrieval practice mastered, but then there's always something. Like, if I think to, again, 2 or 3 years ago, I was doing it and I was thinking, oh, brilliant, I'm retrieval practice, like, this is really good, it's got to be a lot better than what I've done in the past. And it is, but now I think about what I'm doing now and it's much better than what I was doing sort of 2 or 3 years ago. So yeah, I think really collectively within your, you know, within your team, within your department, really thinking about your curriculum and what are the big sort of concepts and ideas, and those are the ones that, you know, spiral through your curriculum, the ones that you're going to pay more attention to, so to speak, than maybe some of those, you know, like you said, their rotation.
That's brilliant. Fascinating. Well, these have been 5 amazing tips, David. Let me hand over to you. What should listeners check out of yours?
What should listeners check out of my... Got a new book coming out with Michael Childs, Year One, which is a book for trainee teachers. Your Tips for Teachers actually features a lot in terms of quotes and ideas sort of from there. So I've got that coming up. My sort of work with Oliver Cavioli, we finished a project with Emma Turner on the extended mind, and about how, similar to some of the ideas that I talked about in here, about how we can sort of spread the load of thinking to manage our working memory. So it's, you know, we think about the tools that we can use that can serve learning, but also manage limitations of working memory. So that was quite an interesting project and something people might find useful.
Fantastic. We'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Well, David, this has been fantastic. I've been a big fan of your work on Twitter for a long time now, so I'm really pleased that you agreed to came on the show. So, David, thank you very much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thank you, Greg.